You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
We made a pact somewhere, sometime in the mid-80s. We said, we are going to spend New Year's Eve, 1990, not 2000, but 1919, under the Eiffel Tower, come what may.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations.
As threats and counterthreats go on over this torn city, the Iron Curtain running through Berlin has today become a cement wall.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore. The wall that the East Germans put up in 1961 to keep its people in will now be breached by anybody one who wants to leave.
The German people awoke this morning as one nation, celebrating the end of 45 years of division and Cold War. Towns and villages across East and West celebrated the final moment of unification. While in Germany's historic capital, Berlin, a freedom bell pealed at midnight and fireworks lit the night sky over the Brandenburg Gate.
In 1986, East German student Antje met a British guy who was installing sewing machines in the hosiery companies in East Germany. Unusually, he was given quite a bit of freedom to socialise locally, and he eventually asked Antje to marry him. However, with her prospective husband being a citizen of the capitalist West, the process was far from simple. Now, talking of the capitalist West, I'm sure you know that some of our fans are helping the podcast financially via Patreon. So if you'd like to join this select band, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Plus, you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster too. Now, back to today's episode. Antje describes her early life in the GDR and how romance blossomed between East and West, despite the best efforts of East German bureaucracy to thwart the Union. Now, the story does have somewhat of a twist towards the end, so make sure you keep on listening right the way through. We recorded our chat at the Barbican Centre in London, so excuse any background noise, but I'm delighted to welcome Antje to Cold War Conversations. Okay, I am here with Antje, who has, without doubt, an interesting story that I think the Cold War Conversations listeners will be interested in. Welcome to Cold War Conversations, Antje.
Thank you, Ian. Lovely to be here. I hope I'm not going to bore you with my story.
I don't think so at all.
I try my best.
At all. So if we can just start off with, when and where were you born?
Well, I was born in 1965 in a small town in the south of what used to be East Germany. In an area called the Erzgebirge, Stolberg it was called. So 1965, Stolberg.
Okay, and who was in your family?
It was initially just my parents. I was the first born. I had a younger brother that was born 3.5 years after me.
Okay, and your parents, what did they do?
My dad comes from an unusual, for us it was quite an unusual background, somewhat privileged. His parents had owned, or his family had owned, a factory locally, and that had been nationalized in the 70s, but he was still working in it as an engineer. He had studied engineering. He was still working in there. It's quite strange because for us it started off as a sort of a playground, because we also lived within the compounds of the company, and we had a flat in there in the sort of administrative building, and it turned out for sort of a playground for us. They gradually scaled that back and we weren't allowed in there anymore. But my dad was still working in that company. And my mum was the secretary to our mayor, our local mayor. She had done secretarial college and all I remember her all my lifetime or my childhood being the secretary to our mayor. Different mayors, same secretary.
Right. Right.
So that was us.
Right. And when the factory was nationalised, were you still allowed to live in the flat within the complex or did you have to move?
Yes, we were because, yes, initially it was partially nationalised. And when it got fully nationalised in the 70s, we lost some privileges like a telephone line, which we had always enjoyed, which was very, very unusual for East Germany. Getting having a private telephone line was just the privileged few that enjoyed that. But somehow we were allowed to rent, to continue renting the space that was that we were occupying in that administrative building. I'm not quite sure now you're asking me. I'm not quite sure why that was. But yes, that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. You were telling me an interesting story a moment ago about the factory being shipped, the machinery of the factory being shipped to the Soviet Union at the end of the war.
That's
which
right.
Obviously you weren't around for.
No,
but you
no.
Saw family
I've only ever
photos.
Seen. I've only ever seen family photos of that. Yes, my grandparents owned the factory, which was a hosiery factory initially. And after the war, we got occupied, obviously, by the Russians. And they dismantled the whole factory. And there are pictures of big crates of machinery that was shipped off. It said, in Cyrillic letters, Leningrad on the side of those boxes that were shipped out from our local train station. And rumor has it they never even arrived in Leningrad. I don't think they ever were put to any good use after they were shipped out. But yeah, my grandmother and her brother, they faced like an empty shell of a factory, which then got turned into semiconductor business. It was partially still privately owned, and my grandmother's brother remained managing director for a while. There was also in the 60s there was actually a play about my grandmother's brother who was running this factory. It was called A Thoroughly Modern Man or something along those lines, because he had changed from being a capitalist to helping the socialist restructuring of Eastern Germany, and he was played by some actor or another. I have always looked, I've been trying to look for it. I thought in the age of, the internet, I would find it somewhere, but I've never found
that it. That was going to be my next question, is who wrote it and where can I find it?
You know what? I don't know.
I'll put the call out to the listeners. They're a diligent band. They might be able to track it down.
That would be so wonderful if I could ever see that.
Well,
I've always wondered about it.
See what we can do there.
Thank you.
The next question I had is, what were your neighbours like? But it sounds like you didn't necessarily have any direct neighbours,
no,
or did you?
No, we didn't. We lived in this administrative building. It was my family, and then above us, my family, and until 1972, next door, I had my grandmother in a little flat, and upstairs, her brother, who enjoyed a big, big flat, because they had basically taken my dad grew up in a big villa that had been built by my great grandfather to a replica of something he saw in Monaco very tastefully. And they obviously got taken away from my dad's family, and they got relocated into this administrative building. And therefore we all sort of lived in there all through my childhood until the 80s, when they were eventually asked to move out.
Right.
So yeah, that there was no direct neighbors as such.
Yeah. And what was your schooling like? I mean, what was your favorite subject?
My schooling was, I still believe, although some might disagree with me, I still think that schooling in East Germany was actually quite good. We enjoyed quite a broad curriculum. It was obviously, it had its limitations, certain things I didn't really like teaching and certain things they taught too much, such as ideological indoctrination. But we got a good general grounding, I think. I was a very diligent student, I've got to admit.
That's good to hear.
So I always did well at school, and I also got the opportunity to move on to what was called a Weiterte Oberschule, which was essentially the gymnasium where you could do what in the rest of Germany would have been called Gymnasium, which basically gave the opportunity to do A levels,
right?
And that's what I eventually moved. Where I eventually moved to do my A levels.
Okay. And what was your favorite subject?
Favorite subject was probably all the humanities, history, German, literature, language, art, music. Not so much. I can't sing for TOEFL.
And history must have had a particular slant, though.
Yes, history did. I very much enjoyed the early history, which was not politically flavored, or not as much anyway. Later on, I mean, history in after the war became, or even between the wars, became quite tedious because it was very, very, very ideological.
Yeah. No, I can imagine.
So.
What were your favorite TV shows as a child?
We had the, for all I can remember, we had the opportunity to watch West German television. There was a period of my childhood when that wasn't possible, but you might have come across this, but the little communities in East Germany would basically club together to get a big aerial on some sort of elevation in the community, which would pick up West German television.
I wasn't aware of that.
Were you not?
No.
That's what happened. And it was sort of tolerated. Not quite sure why, but West Germany would also specifically send signals across so we could pick it up. And so I guess my favorite programs would have probably always been West German programs because we didn't watch all that much East German television. There were some films and some programs that were quite nice. I can't totally remember them now, but I think as kids we always watched West German television. Yeah.
You must have been a fan of the Sand Mansion.
Oh, that's true. Yes. Sand Mansion. And in fact, my children now, when we go to Germany, they've outgrown it. But when they were little, at 7 o'clock every night, we would sit down and watch the Sand Mansion.
Brilliant. It was Magic Roundabout in the UK, I think.
Yes,
we sat down
that was our equivalent. You're right.
So I would imagine you were in the Young Pioneers as well.
I was both in the Young Pioneers and the later on they were called the Thälmann Pioniere, I believe. So you started off with a blue neckerchief and then you advanced onto the red one. It was basically, unless you were... You came from a family that was very anti-establishment. You just joined. It was a matter of course. Yeah. And if you didn't, it came with a lot of problems. So, yeah, I was part of that whole movement. And then later on, of course, the Freie Deutsche Jugend, FDJ, FDJ.
So,
I progressed through the ranks of all
and,
of
and
that.
And did you do any of the military training in the Pioneers? Or in the
I'm
FDJ?
Not sure we did it as the Pioneers so much. It certainly became a big feature later on when we were in the Free German Youth. We had, in fact, when we were when I moved on to do my degree course, part of that was always devoted to sort of military training. It was called civil defense, but it really was very military. They would stick us away somewhere in a camp where we really had to work under military rules and greet. Then there was some sort of military people there that were overseeing all of that as well at the time. Yeah.
They were probably talent spotting for later life, possibly.
Possibly. Although that's an altogether different conversation to be had, what was going on in those camps.
You can't leave that hanging, Antje.
Oh, it was a very odd experience. Stick a few 20-odd-year-olds with some of their lecturers, because our lecturers would come along with us and be our trainers there, in a camp in the middle of nowhere where you are not allowed to go out for, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, 4 weeks possibly. And there was some really very odd goings on.
Okay. We'll stop there.
Yes, possibly.
We'll stop there. Possibly. It's a family show.
Yes.
Did you have any relatives in the West?
Yes, I did. My auntie, my dad's sister, had left in the 50s when it was still possible. And had established herself in West Germany, was married there and had two children. And I remember being about 10 the first time I ever met them, the first time they actually came back. My dad wanted to leave. I mean, it's actually quite a coincidence that I'm even here, because my dad was going to leave the country and join his sister in West Germany in 61. In the summer of 61, he was going to go camping and not to ever come back. And whilst he was camping, they put the wall up and he couldn't leave anymore. They had already had some position for him in the Bundeswehr, from what I gather. Mm. But he was stuck. So I was then eventually born in 65. So obviously he just, you know, came to the conclusion that there was no way out.
Yeah.
But yeah, his sister stayed in West Germany and they didn't come to visit us until, yeah, I was about 10.
Right. And did they send you gifts as well?
Yes, they did. And in fact, my grandmother left in 72 to join her daughter in West Germany, which was quite traumatic for me, because I could never go and visit her after that. The first time I actually went to visit her was after I left in 89. I spent a couple of days over there. She would come and see us occasionally. But yes, they would always send they were obviously precious things when little parcels arrived from the West with coffee and chocolate and, you know, all the little things that they probably bought really cheaply, but we really appreciated.
Yeah, no, I've heard that from other former GDR citizens, of the excitement over the packages.
Absolutely,
from the West. So your grandmother presumably reached pensionable age, at which point she could then go and live in the West, because the East didn't want to then be paying her pension.
Well, yes, they once you had reached pensionable age, they were quite happy for you to just take your stuff and leave, because, as you say, you then weren't a burden on their pocket any longer.
Okay. No, thanks for that. Presumably you visited East Berlin at some point in your childhood?
Yes, quite a lot. Well, my childhood, yes, with my parents occasionally, but certainly when I became a student, a lot of my friends were from Berlin, and I had quite a lot of friends that were were based in Berlin, and so I used to go there very regularly. I still have friends there now.
And how aware were you of the wall and West Berlin? You know, how did you feel? You know, I'm trying to understand what you thought about it. Did you just try and put it out of your mind and avoid it?
No, we always knew it was there, and it was very strange, especially in Berlin, because you could get relatively close and you could actually glance across. And it was relatively odd to think that there was a world over there that we could just never reach. But in the end, it was just the reality that you lived with. When I got older, as I said, when I was a student, used to spend quite a bit of time in Berlin. I had some unusual friends. In fact, one of my friends was from Yemen, and he actually kept a Yemeni passport, and he was allowed to cross. And we would wait for him wherever we could on the eastern side whenever he came back, and we would give him orders for records that we wanted, and he would come back with basically what the goodies that we'd ordered from him. But he could go, we could see him go, we could see him come back, and yet we could never go where he went.
Yeah, it must be a really weird experience.
It was very strange.
There's this other almost mythical city, yes, right next to you that you just can't get to.
Yes, with all the goodies that you could ever want.
Yeah.
It taught you self-restraint, I guess. You always knew that you just couldn't. You would want it, but you couldn't get to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you never, I mean, did you ever think about, oh, how could I get over there, or what?
Well, we made a pact, this whole bunch of friends, that we were quite subversive. There was quite a lot of people that were religious, and you might have come across this, but the church was almost the unofficial opposition in East Germany. And my boyfriend at the time was the son of a vicar, but not just your ordinary village vicar, but somebody who was in politically engaged and would preach. And he was on very much on the radar of the Stasi, so were all his children. And through that, we made a pact somewhere, sometime in the mid 80s. We said, we are going to spend New Year's Eve 1990, not 2000, but 1919, under the Eiffel Tower, come what may. Well, we never did, because then it didn't really matter anymore. By then, the wall had come down anyway. But that was the sort of, that was the ambition for us.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And little did you know that that was
exactly,
actually going to be possible
exactly,
on that day.
Exactly.
That's a great story. When did you talked about being a student. So were you studying in Berlin?
No, I studied in Leipzig at the, that still exists. It wasn't a university. It was called the Handelshochschule. HHL Leipzig, if you want to look it up. It still exists now. It has got quite a good history of economics. I studied economics. It has a very good history of economics. And even during the East German times, it churned out quite a well-educated bunch. But it was quite difficult to get into at the time. And yes, I was lucky enough I wanted to really get into the hotel trade. You know, the big world and the excitement of international trade and international visitors. But there was, out of the 10 seminar groups that they would take in every year, there was only two of them that were for the hotel business. And you had to be very, very clean and ideologically on message
and
to get in there, and I didn't.
And your parents would have to be
card holders. Yes, and my parents were not members of the SED, the main socialist communist party, because my dad's background wasn't right, because he came from a capitalist family. He then became a member of the NDPD. You have to be careful how you say that, which basically was the pool for all the ex-capitalists that wanted to help build a better Germany, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do understand, because I think not people aren't necessarily aware that there were these sort of almost front parties to try and give the impression that it was a multi-party state, yet the SED was pulling all the strings.
Yes, it was. And they basically the farmers had their own party. Then there was the NDBT, was basically all the intelligentsia used to sort of be in there as well. There was a liberal party, LBT. I can't totally remember what it was called, but there was a liberal party. I'm not quite sure who they were trying to fit into that particular straitjacket. But yeah, and in fact, my dad's cousin, became a very high, he became the personal assistant to the leader of the NDBD, because all these little parties provided the, they were like a second in command to Honecker or whoever was in charge in the Politburo. And he, my dad's cousin was the personal assistant to one of these guys. And we got quite a lot of stories out of Berlin at times that...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
I think we weren't allowed to repeat...
So you can't repeat them now?
Well, I can now, but at the time I couldn't. Well, it was little things like he would say, oh, they all lived in this sort of, was it called Glienicke?
Wandlitz.
Wandlitz, that's it. They all lived in Wandlitz, and all the ambassadors also had their local, their residences there. And my dad's cousin's boss had his residence right next to the, French ambassador, who one morning decided to put a fountain outside his home. And because it couldn't be that a Western citizen would have a bigger fountain than the East German neighbor, my relative was dispatched to source a bigger fountain that then ultimately got put into the front garden of
right.
his boss. So little things like that, which I remember when I heard them, went totally against all this ideological stuff that we were being taught about the working classes and stuff. And I remember that churning around in my head thinking, well, that's a bit petty. How does that really work out with the working classes and all of that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a few of those stories kicking around.
Yeah.
That's the one I remember right now, yeah. But there was a few others like that.
I think you're right. It probably was Glienicke, because Wandlitz was where all the East German leaders used to live.
Yes.
And then it was probably diplomatic compound.
It was diplomatic compound, that's right. And it was probably Glienicke, if I remember rightly.
Yeah. And... You said you studied economics. I mean, that must have been with quite a socialist slant.
Yes, very, very. It was very red.
Yeah, it's basically nationalize everything and sell stuff to the West.
Well, they did tell us, they did give us an idea into Keynes and Adam Smith. And so we did learn about the alternative theories.
Oh, that's interesting.
But we obviously were told that ours was much superior.
Okay, so when you finish your... Did you get a degree, an economics degree?
I did, yes, I did.
When you finished that, where did you go to work?
Well, the system in East Germany was such that in the last year of your studies, they would basically, because it was all planned... everybody that had a job, everybody that was studying would also get a job. So the amount of students that were in the year would, this is how many jobs would come to the university or to the higher education organization, whoever you were studying with. And they would then be distributed. Obviously, the first choice of jobs would go to the highest achievers. I had, whilst I had been very good at school, once my parents, or I got out of my parents' house and I was become a little freer, I neglected my studies somewhat, and I also didn't quite see the point in some of the stuff that I had to study, which was, as we just established, very ideologically coloured. So I wasn't quite in the top tier, and what I got to pick from was essentially one of the local Ha'oz, which is the which was one of the retail organizations in East Germany. We had Konsum und Ha'oz, and they were organized that you had a local center, and they were looking for somebody. I can't even remember what the job was meant to be, but somewhere locally they were looking for somebody to help them with something. And I took the job, but by then I had already met my husband to be, and I knew I wasn't going to work there. And it sort of, it sent me down a real rabbit hole of worries, and I didn't really know how to address it. I didn't want them to think that I was coming, and then be disappointed that I wasn't going to come. They had to find me a flat. I even had to go through the motions of viewing flats and approving them. And in the end, I actually rang the boss there and said, look, I'm going to tell you something now that I'm sure I shouldn't be telling you, but I am not going to start with you because I'm going to get married and I'm going to move to Britain.
Okay, which brings us on to one of the reasons I found your story interesting, although what you've just told me is equally fascinating detail as well. So how did you meet your future husband?
Right. I was at college in Leipzig, and I came home for one of the study holidays, and I come from a very rural area, and the next village from where my parents lived had the head office of the hosiery industry in East Germany. Mm-hmm. And they would buy in equipment, in this case sewing machines, from the West, because obviously the East couldn't provide it. And with the equipment came the engineers that would install it. And usually they were kept under very close observation. They weren't really allowed to mingle too much. And I don't really to this day understand what happened, but these two English guys turned up locally and they were allowed to just go to local discos. And it was obviously much excitement amongst everybody. So I met Tim. He didn't speak any. I managed to. My English was probably better than most of the other local girls, so I had a competitive advantage.
Oh, always good, always good.
And we eventually had, started something like a relationship. And he asked me to marry him very early on, but I think he asked me to marry him because he wanted to get me out of the country. He felt sorry for me. And I said, no, I'm going to finish my studies. If you're still hanging around for that long, then we can consider it after that. And so we had a long distance relationship in a way. He would come back, and we had to sort of be quite subversive because I didn't want to have any problems at university. So he would just get invitations from people I vaguely knew that didn't have much to lose and never really stay with them. And I'm sure the local Stasi people knew what was going on, but somehow we went through the whole charades. He did actually book into a hotel the first time he came back. He would come back and visit me regularly, and we would sometimes meet in Hungary or in the Czech Republic and could be on holiday together.
Yeah.
But we could never go there together or leave together. Yeah. He could drop me to the border and then I had to cross my way and he had to go his way.
So when did you first meet him? What year was that?
86, I think.
Okay. And what did you like about him?
Well, he was English. I mean,
Well, it was. I've always been a bit of an adventurer in my days. And he was just the most exciting thing ever. But he was also very handsome, and he was a proper gentleman, and he was just very different to anybody I had ever met before. Yeah. He was tall, and he traveled a lot because he would not just install machinery in East Germany. He went frequently to South America, and he was all over the place, Switzerland, and I would always get postcards from wherever he was. Yeah.
Well, the Stasi must have definitely been on your...
They must have known, Unfortunately, my Stasi files, because I moved to England before the wall, before East Germany was dissolved in a way, my files came to the German embassy, and they still had enough time to shred everything. And they did actually send us a letter in 1990 saying... Assuming you're something along the lines, assuming your agreement, we have gotten rid of all your files. And at the time, I remember thinking, yeah, all right then. But what I didn't realize was that they had basically gotten rid of all my Stasi files.
So basically, your file was transferred to the East German embassy in the UK.
That's right, yeah.
And that's what they must have done with any East German citizen that moved to the UK.
I was number 35. I was the 35th East Germany in the UK, apparently.
Wow. That few. I would have thought there'd be more than that.
No, but when I got here, because they would also do Christmas parties at the East German embassy, which was basically just their way of checking in with everyone. But, you know, if you get an invite to your your embassy's Christmas party, you don't refuse. I still got one invitation to the Christmas party 89 at the East German Embassy in Belgrave Square. And there we talked, and there was every East German in the UK was invited. Not everybody turned up because a few of them lived in Scotland, but there was actually somebody who came down from Scotland for it. And I was told then that I was number 35.
Right. Interesting. So these East German citizens still felt a loyalty to East Germany. To turn up for something like that, they must have felt something.
Well, of course. You always feel a loyalty towards the country you were born in, educated in, and grew up in. Even if you despise it, there is an element of it's familiarity. It's what you know. You know, and once you are in London, you know that you're quite free and you can come in there and you can leave again. And that, in fact, if people would have been able to come and go as they please, they probably would have lost a few more, but people wouldn't have wanted the whole country to go wholesale, I think.
Yeah, you might have been number 3,000,035 if they'd allowed that. I mean, was that really the only contact that the East German embassy insisted on having with you once you'd moved to the UK?
Well, they couldn't really insist on anything anymore. That also dawned on me much later on. I still had an East German passport. So this was obviously, I was still, you know, I was very much still officially East German. But they told me when they handed me the passport in East Germany before I left, that I should go to the East German embassy in London to register myself. I didn't know that I didn't really have to do that, but it was so entrenched in me I just couldn't even imagine not doing it. And so I did, and I registered myself. And so that's how they kept a bit of an eye on you, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's a really interesting, insight there. But we have sort of jumped ahead a bit, because obviously you start this relationship with Tim in 86. It's long distance. He has to go away. You're still in East Germany. He's sending you letters. He's writing to you.
Yep.
And then you decide to get married.
Yes. Yes, true. I basically went to the equivalent of the Citizens Advice Bureau in Leipzig at the time.
how naive of me, to inquire what I would need to do. And I was absolutely terrified because I thought any minute now they're really just going to take me away.
Yeah,
and
the guys in the leather jackets are going to turn up.
Yeah, in the Max they would turn up. Nobody ever did, funnily enough. But the guy didn't really, whoever I saw at the time, didn't really give me any real advice. But I made on. I also went to the with Tim to the British Embassy. That was another terrifying moment because I thought, oh, the men in the Max, because they hung around all the.
You mean in Berlin?
In Berlin.
In Berlin, the British mission, or because it wasn't an official embassy.
No,
was
it was probably just a mission in Berlin, in East Berlin.
Yeah.
That was another terrifying moment because I thought, I'm sure I'm not allowed to do this. But anyway, I did, and they gave some advice. And I remember walking in there, seeing the picture of the Queen, and thinking how very quaint.
Did we offer you tea?
You must have done. I can't imagine that you didn't, but I probably would have refused it because tea to this day is not quite my drink. But, yeah, so I remember being very excited over the fact that I had actually set foot on British soil, effectively. So, yes, we did. We made inquiries, always being slightly worried that something might happen, but nothing ever really did. What you had to do was you had to apply for marriage to a Western citizen. They had just reduced the period of time it would take to get a response from 6 months to 3 months when we did, and that was in early 89. I finished my studies in the March of 80, no, in probably January 89, and I then immediately applied and got a response within 3 months. But you weren't allowed to book an actual a date for your in any of the registry offices, because we had to get married in a local registry office, but you weren't, and dates were like gold dust. I don't know why they didn't give enough of them out, evidently, and you had to book them well in advance. But because I had to wait for my response, I did quite sneakily book the date provisionally. I had to bribe some people. I was working temporarily in just a local shop. And as you well know, East Germany was always short of everything. Tomato ketchup was a big one. And when we got a delivery of tomato ketchup in my local shop, I kept a few bottles to one side to then bribe the registrar to give me a date without officially giving me a date.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
So I got my date before I got the yes, but I got the yes that I could go ahead. We got married on the 4th of July, 89.
I'm sorry, I was just going to ask you, did you meet Tim's parents before then?
Oh, yes, they did come over. Oh, God, my mum will still tell you about the traumatic experience that was.
Oh, we'll have to get your mum on.
She doesn't speak English. No.
Well, tell me the story.
Well, Tim was one of four, and his entire... And we did live by then. We had moved out of the flat that I was telling you earlier. They had to give us a living space that was a similar size to what we had before, and because we had a relatively big flat, we got offered for very little money to move into a detached house, which was lovely. In 1930s built, it had actually belonged to a family member of mine who had passed away. Beautiful house. And we moved in there, so we had quite a lot of space. And when we felt that we needed to get the families together, and Tim was very, my parents are very German, everything has to be just so, and Tim's family was very, oh yeah, you know, his mum is half Spanish, and it was all a bit, yeah, we will sort this out, don't worry about it. And they turned up, a lot of them, and they all camped out in our house, and my mum nearly lost the will to live. She couldn't really communicate with them. They would make a mess in the bathroom every morning. She will still tell you if you would, if your German was good enough and you would ask her about it, she will still tell you what my daughter put me through. Yeah, so that was, they were only there for about 4 days, but my mum was very much on the verge of a mental breakdown.
She was traumatized by their visit. Okay, so let's go back to the wedding. So it's a registry office in Berlin, was this?
No, it was a local registry office. I was not going to get married in white. I, for some reason, had it in my head I was going to get married in red. We then suggested to all of the visitors, including Tim's family, all the British visitors, including his family, that this was a condition, that if you wanted to get married to a Westerner, it had to be in red, which is obviously not true, but they all, oddly enough, they all believed it. So yeah, I got married in red, with a hat that came from the local market in High Wycombe, from what I gather.
This gets better all the time.
I know. I looked fabulous. And
hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah, so the one unusual thing about it was, as well as everything else, my brother had by then been conscripted into the army. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't allowed out, only for very special occasions. And your sister getting married was a special occasion. However, your sister getting married to an Englishman was not a special occasion. So we had to have, because my mum was the secretary to the mayor who would have to vouch for him, he actually wrote to the army saying, can you let this young man out? And he omitted to tell them that it was a marriage to an English guy. And I think communication wasn't quite up to scratch on that one. They let my brother out for the wedding. But we were all basically told that we had to keep very quiet because he could get into all sorts of trouble for this, because he was basically contact with the enemy, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah, that was, we did get him out. He was there.
Yeah.
And we got married and, spent our wedding night in Chemnitz, or what used to be Karl Marxstadt.
Yeah.
In a hotel Moscow, oddly enough, in Karl Marxstadt.
It sounds so romantic,
doesn't it?
Yeah, the hotel Moscow in Karl Marxstadt. I'll have to look that one up. So, how soon after the wedding did you leave the GDR?
I then had to go through. So this was in July 89, and whilst there was already quite a lot of signs that this wasn't going well, and Hungary had opened their borders to Austria and quite a few people were escaping, I still had to go through the official paperwork to leave East Germany. So that was my first step. I had to get an exit visa out of East Germany, and for that I had to have, there was a checklist, I had to have every utility company that I'd ever been somehow in contact with, they had to sign me off that I didn't owe them anything. This was quite clearly just a way of making this whole process very difficult. And you had to turn up in person, and they were really horrible to you. But so I got that. Then you had to list everything you wanted to take. You had to list. And it had to be in 5 copies. These were the days before. Well, I guess West Germany had photocopying, but East Germany was still very much working on
carbon paper. Yeah.
And I had to type everything out on a conventional typewriter on carbon copy. And anything that I wanted to take that could have been of cultural value had to be given to somebody that was officially able to sign it off and say she can take that.
And did you have anything of cultural value?
Well, I did, yeah, because my parents had quite a few antiques, and I had been given by my grandmother when she passed away, and other members of the family, some antique bits and pieces that were in my possession. I had to basically take them somewhere a person who had to sign it off and say, yeah, that's fine to take out. And also books, any old books over, I can't remember, anything that was over 50 years old, I had to actually take to somebody to say, no, it's not a first edition, she can take it.
Right, right.
So and that paperwork had to be with me as well. So I had to list everything, wait for the exit visa. Then I had to apply for transit visas through, because my husband was coming to pick me up in the car. So I needed transit visas through Belgium and France, and I needed an entrance visa into Britain. So I had to apply for them. And eventually I got all the paperwork together, and we left he came with an old Astra and a trailer on the back.
So a Vauxhall Astra with a trailer on the back.
That's it. That's how I left East Germany in style.
Cool. Can you just take me through that day and how you felt that day? Presumably you were just more than excited that you were leaving, or were you worried about, you know, losing contact with relatives and things like
that? I was mainly excited. I was 23 years old. I got out of this country. I was actually going to cross that border that seemed uncrossable all my lifetime. I was going to see London, which was like unbelievable at the time. So yes, I was very excited. My parents were very sad, obviously, but I guess I'd been quite awkward. They were probably, to some extent, a little bit glad to see the back of me.
Yeah, you're his problem now.
Yeah, a little bit like that. I was most sad to leave my brother. I remember saying goodbye to them in front of the house. And I sort of, it was a very quick goodbye to my parents. Although my dad, who didn't show emotions particularly easily, he gave me a good luck charm, and he said, look after it. And I found my brother most difficult to say goodbye to. And then off we went. And then we weren't going straight to the UK. We were going to come past my grandmother's, who, as I said, I had never visited before. So I spent the next 3 days with my grandmother in Nordrhein-Westfalen. That was quite I remember actually, as we'd crossed the border, we got to the border, they looked at my paperwork. They never even took 5 copies. I was most put out by that. I felt like saying, take them. I have spent hours doing these. But they took one glance at them, waved us through, gave us our stamps. And then I arrived on the West German side, and they just waved us through. And then there was like a petrol station, and I could just go in there, and there was all this stuff that I had never seen in a shop, and it was quite odd.
Yeah, it must have been. I mean, I've sort of heard others sort of mention that it was almost a bit like a sensory overload in terms of the colours and the choice.
Yes, it was. It's colours and choices. I do remember thinking that it's just too much choice. That was just a petrol station. But as I then
came especially to Britain and I saw the big Tesco's, I remember thinking, who needs this much coffee or these many varieties of it?
I still ask that question myself, to be honest.
True. So, and then I spent a few days with my grandmother and then we set off. Again, we then went via Mönchengladbach because Tim's cousin was actually stationed with the forces in Mönchengladbach. Spent a few hours there and then set off on our way. This was on the 9th of November, 89. Set off on our way.
That date sounds familiar.
Doesn't it? Yes. But we still didn't know that this was going to happen. Still, nobody in the morning knew what was going to happen that evening. So I remember actually reading the supplement to the Sunday Times in Mönchengladbach because we were at the forces. And it on the front cover of the magazine, there was a big picture of Karl Marx. And at the bottom, it said RIP. And I remember asking, what does RIP mean? And I was explained that this means rest in peace. So the writing was on the wall, but we took off. We were exhausted by then, but we took off through Belgium, and it was quite late by then. And we were listening to the World Service in the car, and just before, about 20 minutes before we crossed over, or we reached the French border, they announced on the World Service that they had opened the crossings in Berlin, that the wall had come down.
And what? How did you feel about that?
I don't know. It was just, I couldn't believe it. And for me, oddly enough, the main reaction was, God, I went through all this hassle and I could have just walked through 3 days later.
Yeah.
It was just mainly, really?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
And Tim was a bit annoyed. He said, we've missed the biggest party in Europe by a few days. And then we reached 20 minutes later, we reached the French border, and I needed all my paperwork be stamped, and they needed to see my visa. And so I had to actually go and show my passport, and the French border guard looked at my passport and he couldn't believe it, and he just said words to the extent of, wow, you were quick. Because they had obviously just heard what was going on, and 20 minutes later, he saw his first East German passport there. Yeah. He wanted to keep it as a souvenir, but I said, no, I still need it.
Yeah. Did you not think, I'm going to have to go and be under the Eiffel Tower on 1990 New Year's Eve?
No, it had sort of, I think we all sort of knew that probably went out of the window at that point. Once it was easily achieved, it didn't become an issue any longer.
It wasn't the challenge that you'd set before.
That's right.
And so how soon did you get reunited with your family?
Well, we went back for Christmas. So we left early November, and the idea was always that I was going to go back for Christmas. However, because the time frame was very tight and because Tim had to apply for visas every time, and I had to get because I didn't have a multiple entry visa into Britain, I had to get an exit visa and a re-entrance visa, and it all became too much for me. In the end, I just went to the West German embassy in London, and I said, because West Germany had never recognized East German citizenship as such, so I just walked into the embassy in Belgrave Square, and I said, can you just issue me with a West German passport? And they lectured me at the time. I remember this was still, you still got quite personal service then. Now it's a conveyor belt. But then they took me into a room and said, we have to tell you that this is illegal under your law. And I just looked at them and I said, I think they've got other problems at the moment. And they laughed and said, yeah, you're probably right. So I ended up, Tim and his brother, who came with us, left without having a visa and just thinking, oh, it will be fine. And I went with two passports. I basically used my West German passport to get through Belgium, France, and out of Britain.
And then I just used the East German passport when I approached the East German border. And when we approached the East German border for that Christmas, I was really, really nervous because I thought, I've got a West German passport in this car. If they search us, I'm in trouble. But they were so relaxed. At that point, everything had already, you know, sort of, they let it all hang loose. And and Tim didn't have a visa and they let him through.
Yeah.
Which was unthinkable 6 months before.
Yeah.
And they just went, oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Seems to be open for everybody now, so just go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I saw my family that Christmas.
Yeah. That must have been quite emotional because, you know, the whole fact that they could now come and visit you in London and...
It was odd. Yeah, it was the first person that did come to visit me was my brother that spring. And if you look up, the May of 1990 was very hot. And my brother turned up thinking this was going to be foggy and horrible English weather. With all his thick clothes, he had to go and buy shorts. And we went down to Brighton and he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So that was the first person that came and visited me.
Wow, wow! And was he still in the MVA?
No, he was gone. He had an early discharge as well because he was actually quite worried because he wasn't in the army in the MVA, as you say, during the demonstrations, the Monday demonstrations, and they had been mobilized, and. He was close to Leipzig where the Monday demonstration started. And his unit was on high alert. And I remember him saying, what if they actually mobilize us? Because under normal circumstances, I would be on that side of the fence and I can't see myself shooting or doing anything. Yeah. He was really quite scared. But then when it all had come about and the wall had come down, he enjoyed a very, very free army life. And he got, he left, I think they got disbanded after a year, which usually would have been 18 months, but he left after a year and that was it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's just an amazing story that you've just told me, which I'm sure... our listeners will be really interested in. I just have two more questions
for
you, which are what are your fondest memories of the GDR?
I think there was the security blanket that we all did have. When I first arrived in England, we were actually quite poor. We hardly had the money to pay for our rent on a monthly basis. I didn't have a job. And I remember thinking, doesn't anybody care? And there was this sudden feeling, yes, you're free, but nobody actually cares anymore either. Because there was an element of, you felt important when you knew that people were listening to you all the time. That gave you a certain feeling of people actually care what you think. And I think with hindsight, that was an odd feeling of security. That might sound a bit bizarre, but...
I don't think so. I think, you know, you knew that you were going to get a job. You knew you were going to get a wage. There would be somewhere to live.
Yeah, there was never this existential fear that maybe if you didn't get a paycheck next month, the whole thing might be going downhill.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. So what was the worst thing about living in the GDR, would you say?
Having to watch what you were saying and where you, there is another story of a friend. I came very close to experiencing what it meant to be on the wrong side of the political law, if you want. When I was 18, I had my best friend who was 19. Her parents applied to leave for the West, and she was already an adult, but she had a younger sister who was 13. And there was obviously all sorts of problems with that initially. But her dad one day was ordered into the Ministry of Interior, which was never a good thing. And her mum went with him. I guess she regretted that for the rest of her life, but they never came back. They were basically imprisoned. There was a trial, and I was sort of very close to my friend, and she then had to manage herself, her sister, and eventually her parents' release as well. For a 19-year-old, that was quite a tough thing to do. And this fear of something could happen to you if you don't toe the line, I think that's probably the worst thing that I experienced.
And I think that's a very good contrast to what you said about the fondest memory of,
yes,
of the GDR, that there was that double-edged sword,
yes,
that every citizen had to deal with.
Yeah.
Antje, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us, and I hope being on Cold War Conversations wasn't too bad for you.
Thank you for listening to me, and pleasure was all mine.
Thank you.
Take care.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that story of the Cold War. I found that really interesting and a different angle that I hadn't expected at all. If you'd like to see photos of Antje's wedding, then head over to our show notes, which are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 82. This will also show as a link in some podcast apps. Don't forget, if you'd like to get that sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster and help keep us on the air, then head over to patreon.com/coldwarpod, or again, click on the link in your podcast app. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners, just like you, continue the Cold War conversation. Just search Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Thanks for listening right through to the end. I really appreciate it. And maybe check out our store and see if you can find the ideal gift for the Cold War enthusiast in your life. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/store. Thanks for listening.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.